On this holiday, then, again, this is the holiday of Asala Puja. It's the July full moon. It's slightly late this year because of a lunar leap year. But this is the traditionally the ceremonial day that immediately precedes the rains retreat. So the Vasa or Vasa, the 3 month rainy season retreat begins tomorrow. So all the monastics nearby are going into their caves, like hibernating bears for the rains. And the three yearly holidays in the Buddhist system, Vesak in May, Asala Puja in July, in January. What's the January holiday? It's funny. It's the Sangha one. I always forget where the Patimokkha was first recited. These three holidays are known as Buddha Day, Dhamma Day, and Sangha Day, and Magga Puja in January. Magga Puja. So Vesak celebrates the Buddha's birth, awakening, and death. Asala Puja celebrates the first transmission of the Dhamma, the turning of the wheel, and the preaching of the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta. And Magga Puja in January celebrates a moment in the first year of the Buddha's ministry, the first or second year, when all of the first batch of fully awakened monastics spontaneously on the same full moon night came back to where the Buddha was staying for a big gathering to celebrate being together. So Asala Puja, here we are, you know, 3 months after the laying out of 2 months after the awakening of the Buddha, and we have the Buddha leaving the Bodhi tree, leaving the banks of the river where he was awakened, and going to seek out his five friends. He had been practicing with them for quite a bit of time before his awakening, and it's with them that he had been doing these harsh bodily mortification practices. And when he had the vision that those practices were not the way to peace, not the way to liberation, and he decided to nourish his body, that he needed to care for the body differently in order to accomplish the awakening that he could tell was possible, they lost faith in him as a peer on the spiritual path, as a spiritual friend, and they left. So they walked maybe 100 miles or so away to near Varanasi or Benares, the ancient city on the banks of the Ganga, still there, the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world, 4,000 years old. So it was old when they walked to it, and it's older now. The Buddha had, Gotama, not yet the Buddha, had this insight that destroying the body didn't actually contribute to the process of purifying the heart. And he had been under the sense, he had been experimenting with the sense that it would, you know, to see if, like, if you really wreck the body and put it through incredible pain and learn to bear that with equanimity, but really cause, you know, more and more incredible pain, would that actually burn up the karmic threads that were leading to unhappiness? And he had this insight that it wouldn't. And that insight was interwoven with the ritual, now in its 20th year, being done by a woman in the nearby town named Sujata, who had been praying for, 20 years before, had prayed to that very tree, to a great tree spirit, for a child. She had been become pregnant and had a healthy child, and had promised every year to come back with an offering for the spirits of the land, the tree spirit that was there. And so on this, the 20th year, she started having auspicious dreams and made the most magnificent offering of milk rice she'd ever made, kind of divinely pure, extraordinarily rich. And so her offering and gratitude for her giving birth merged with Gotama's insight that the body must be nourished. And of course, she brings him milk rice. When she comes to see him, her own breasts begin to lactate. And it said that she had been the Buddha's mother in 100 previous lifetimes. And so they know each other, actually. And she is ready to nourish him in his last, in the last evening of his life in samsara, before he crosses the great river into nibbana, to freedom. And so, you know, she gives him that offering and blesses him. She says, as my, you know, as my desire was granted, so may yours be. And he sits down and strengthened by this foo, by this encounter with his mother, by the support of the divine feminine under a great tree by the banks of a river, he sees himself through all time and space, and sees how beings are reborn in accordance with their actions, and seeing so liberates the heart from suffering fully. After this auspicious night, he rests near the Bodhi tree for many weeks, 7 weeks, it's said, and experiencing the bliss of deliverance and going over some of the insights that he had understood. In one of the places, he thinks through the links of dependent origination forward and then backward and then forward and backward, just understanding this is how suffering comes to be. This is how suffering is ended. This is how suffering comes to be. This is how suffering is ended. He really creates or formalizes the teachings that would become the Dhamma, the Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the links of dependent origination, the aggregates. All of this he puts together as a set of insights in these 2 months of self-retreat following his awakening. And then near the end of that self-retreat, he reflects to himself, this Dhamma to which I have awakened is subtle, not easy to realize. People are enraptured by desire, bound by lust and greed, deluded, not interested even in freedom. They will not understand this Dhamma, and to try to get them to understand would be frustrating. Hearing this, one of the gods, Brahma Sahampati, up in his heaven realm, perked up and said, wait, the Blessed One is on the edge of not teaching. And the text says, as quickly as a strong man would flex his extended arm or extend his flexed arm, Brahma Sahampati disappeared from the Brahma realm and appeared in front of the Buddha, bowing and arranging his robe on one shoulder as a sign of respect. He said, Blessed One, you're wrong. There are beings in the world with little dust in their eyes who would benefit from hearing the Dhamma. Teach those people for their well-being and for their liberation. They will be able to hear it. And the Buddha only then extended his divine eye that is purified and more powerful than the human, the texts say, and extended it out over the world and the universe. And he saw that Brahma Sahampati was right, that there were in fact beings with little dust in their eyes who could benefit from the Dhamma that he taught. And in his heart, he resolved to teach for the benefit of beings. And Brahma Sahampati saw this happen in his heart and thought to himself, my work here is done. Bowed circumambulating him, keeping him on his right, all of these little phrases. This is just how the texts go. So this is kind of the oral tradition telling, right? So keeping him on his right, and then as quickly as a strong man would flex his extended arm or extend his flexed arm, he disappeared right from there and reappeared in the Brahma realm. The Buddha then thought to himself, who would benefit from these teachings? Who would be able to understand them? And he immediately thought of his two teachers. He hadn't seen them for years because he'd been doing ascetic practice, but his first two meditation teachers, Udaka, son of Rama, Udaka Ramaputta, and Alara Kalama, he had learned these two very deep formless meditations from them. And they invited him to co-lead their sanghas, but their practice led to very, very high states and led to heaven realms, but didn't lead to the full uprooting of suffering. And so he had left them, but he respected them very much. And they were the first ones he thought of. Oh, I'll go to where they are. They would understand this and become liberated very quickly. And he looked out with his divine eye, with his clairvoyance, and he saw that both of them had recently died. And there's a way that this mirrors this moment that had happened right at the Buddha's birth. In the stories around the Buddha's birth, it's said that, you know, the child had all these auspicious signs that he was going to be a great being, and so they invited some sages to come and see him. And this one sage came and saw him, and, you know, looked at his feet and his auspicious marks and all of that, and then burst into tears. And the Buddha's father said, What is it? Have you seen the signs of misfortune? What's happening? And the sage, weeping, said, no. This child is going to be the most amazing teacher in the world, but I will die before he matures into his teaching. I won't get to hear him. And he's just weeping, that could be because he can see it. And so, you know, flash forward, you know, 30, 33 years, and the Buddha is seeing that his two teachers, who he was so grateful for, have died, and they won't be able to hear the teachings that he's offering. And so then he says, well, you know, my friends are actually quite wise, quite powerful, quite beautiful practitioners. Maybe they will understand. And he looks out with his clairvoyance, and he sees that they've gone to Varanasi. So he packs up his robe and bowl and sets out walking to Varanasi. And he walks all the way. On the road, on the way to Varanasi, he passes by someone who notices that he looks quite amazing, quite peaceful. He's kind of shining, really. And this person he passes on the road says, sir, you are clearly a very accomplished spiritual being. Who is your teacher? And the Buddha says, I have no teacher. Right? He had teachers, but no one taught him the thing that he's now radiant with, right? That was an intuition that arose on its own in his being. So he says, I have no teacher. And the person says, Are you a god? Like you're luminous. Like I've never seen anyone who looks like you. Are you human? He says, are you a god? The Buddha says, no. He says, are you human? The Buddha says, no. What are you? The Buddha says, I'm awake. But then he goes a little bit further. So we like that answer. I'm awake, right? That's a really good answer. Like Zen just cuts right through. But then he goes a little bit further and he says, you know, I am the greatest in the world. I am unsurpassed. No one has realized anything beyond me. There are none that are my equal. And this is just a bit too much for this guy. He can't quite connect. And he says, well, good for you, friend, and walks on. And you know, like, why would they make this story up? Like, right, this is canonical. This is in the texts. It's mysterious, right? Here's the Buddha. Newly awakened, they've spun all these extraordinary myths about how luminous he is. And then the first person he meets, you know, has dust in his eyes, basically, right? He's not one of those people who doesn't have dust in his eyes. He says, well, yeah, good for you. you're great. You know, I'm going to the store. See ya, whatever. And you know, don't let that be you, I think, is the moral of that story, right? When the Buddha passes you on the road, stop, like listen, listen, you know. So that guy could have been the first disciple, but you know, he'll loop back around. His karma, he had good karma. He met the Buddha. Wow, right? He just wasn't quite ready. I know the feeling. And so, you know, I met Leonard Cohen when I was 23. I wasn't ready either. So there you go. I was like, oh, good for you, friend. And you know, I was like, who are you? And he's like, oh, I'm Leonard Cohen. And I was like, huh. Good for, and I mean, I kind of knew who he was, but so I wasn't quite good for you, friend. But I, you know, I wouldn't really get it for many years hence. So the Buddha goes to Varanasi, and he goes to a little place called there's a little town called Sarnath. It's a couple miles north of Varanasi, across the river, and there's a little natural area. There's a park there, and his five friends are practicing there. So the Buddha comes walking up to them. And you know, they don't quite get it at first. They're like, oh, there's that guy, he fell off the path. Let's not offer him water to wash his feet. Let's not get up, you know, respectfully when he comes. Let's not offer him a seat. The Buddha walks up and he says, friends, why are you, this is not appropriate to be so rude, you know, to a great teacher. And they're like, he does actually look kind of amazing right now. They say, well, all right, we'll be polite. So they offer him a seat, they wash his feet, you know. And then, you know, at least it seems like, you know, according to the text, he says, you know, no, really, I found the way. Like, sit down, I'm gonna tell you. And initially they're a little bit like, okay, well, we'll listen to, they're skeptical. They'll listen to what he has to say. And then he lays on them the text we just chanted, the setting in motion, the wheel of the Dhamma. And so, you know, everything that he realized, all of that insight, all of that power, what's the first thing he chooses to say to these people he'd been practicing with, to his friends? Right? First, he addresses their practice. Right, so these are ascetics. They're doing self-mortification practice, and he came from wealth, right? And so there's this dialectic, or this kind of, you know, tension between the life of sensual pleasures, where you're relying on contact with pleasurable things to keep you happy, right? More pleasure, more happiness, right? That's the path of wealth, right? If you can keep the sensual pleasures coming, pretty good. Good for you, friend, right? Then there's, on the other side, there's the ascetic path, where you've turned away from the idea that sensual pleasures will make you happy, but you've swung to the other side and you've said, like, I'm actually going to embrace pain and discomfort in a way to try to, like, maybe to disconnect fully, or to even be in a different kind of devotional state around the body through pain. And the Buddha addresses these two, and he says, I've realized the middle way that leads to the end of suffering, and it is the middle way between sensual indulgence and bodily mortification. And sensual indulgence is deluded, pointless, ignoble, like not really respectable, and it doesn't work, right? And fruitless. Bodily mortification is painful, ignoble, and fruitless. So it's painful. In a certain way, culturally, the ascetic life was more respectable. People respected ascetics. It's respectable when you see someone who can really do hardship. You know, there's a certain strength there. So they were respected. But the Buddha was saying, but it still doesn't work. It doesn't get you there. So there is a middle way between these two. So he comes out in a culture that actually venerates extremes in a certain way. Like, the ascetic practices are quite extreme, really. And there's always been a veneration in South Asian culture for people who can go all the way, who can really just push it, you know, who can turn the dial up to 11 and do their practice there. You know, the Buddha was like, oh, starvation, I can do that better than anyone. You know, pain, I can go further than anyone. And you know, he was from the warrior caste. He was a Kshatriya or Kshatriya in Sanskrit. This is the warrior aristocrat class. So he was trained to be the best and to go the furthest and to be the strongest and the most educated. And, you know, he's got that personality, right? I am the greatest in the world. The fact that he actually is, you know, like, good for you, friend, like you're not lying, but it's hard to bear sometimes. You meet someone who's that bright and knows it, you know. So there's a lot of respect to be given to people who can go all the way. And so he had gotten that respect. And then he lost the respect when it seemed like he was backing off from the edge there. But he says there's a middle way between sensual indulgence, wealth, and bodily mortification, torture. And the middle way is the Eightfold Path. And so many of you know the Eightfold Path, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right immersion or concentration. And so one thing we can notice just here at the beginning of this text is that the thing he's rejecting is these two poles of really physical obsession. One is an obsession with physical pleasure, sensual pleasure, and the other one is an obsession with physical pain and torture. And the thing he replaces them with, the thing that is the middle way, is not particularly physical. It's actually much more psychological, energetic, and ethical. So the first two limbs are view and intention. So you orient yourself toward what's true, and then you set up new intentions based on that, right? And the classical intentions are, you know, the intention toward kindness, the intention toward renunciation, the intention toward harmlessness, right? So none of these are about what you get in your body. They're not about the pleasure you get or the pain you get. They're really about setting up your mind state, the state of your heart, really, to be oriented toward non-harming and peacefulness. So there's a whole turn here that is social, because the precepts in non-harming are all relational. There's a turn that is social and psychological and emotional. And so that's really, he says, like, no, look in these channels. Don't look in the physical channel, either in relation to pain or pleasure. He's going to say, like, yeah, sensual pleasures, they happen. Painful things, they happen. Neither of those actually holds the key to liberation. That's actually just, that's sort of like the ecosystem of the body experiences those things. But there's something else. There's a different place to look. And it's in the middle. And the thing that's in the middle starts with how we look at the world and the intentions we give rise to. And then the next three limbs are all action. They're all relational. And this is sila, the ethical limbs. So wise speech or right speech, right action, which is the first three precepts, not killing, not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct. And then, so with the speech, you have all four initial precepts, right? And most modern people figure that the fifth one is implied. The fifth one comes in and out of the lists at different times. That's the precept against intoxicating yourself to the point of heedlessness. And so you get these limbs that establish wise action, right speech, right action. And then you get a limb that takes that action really out into your life in the world, the limb of right livelihood, which I think is the least appreciated of the limbs. It's like, yeah, my job, whatever. But I think that what livelihood really means is how do we, through our actions, engage with a wide circle out in the room, out in the world, right? So if non-harming is like, yeah, I don't kill people or animals, you know, if I can, as much as I can. And if wise speech is, you know, I try to speak in ways that are helpful and kind and timely and truthful. Both of those things affect my immediate circle, which is where a lot of my drama happens, but my livelihood can affect people on the other side of the planet, you know, and that was true then, it's true now. You know, people were already passing trade and goods from China through India all the way to Greece and Europe. That was happening, right? So, you know, you could be buying Chinese silk, and you know, maybe you know that the silkworms all get murdered in the making of silk. You know, we're not the first ones to think about the global supply chain and wonder about harm. The Buddha was saying, like, well, attend to the harm that's caused. You know? So we get these ethical limbs. Again, they're not about the experiences that the body has. They're about what the body does to others, actually. And then you have the meditative limbs of right effort, right mindfulness, and right immersion. So in right effort, there's the cultivating of wholesome states and the diminishing of unwholesome states. And these are mostly emotional and energetic, right? The cultivation of the awakening factors, mindfulness, investigation, you know, energy, joy, or bliss, or rapture, tranquility, concentration, equanimity, and the diminishing of the hindrances of, you know, sensual desire and ill will, hatred, and the diminishing of sloth and torpor and restlessness and worry and skeptical doubt, the mind killer. So we have a path that is now really turning toward the energetic states that define our moment-to-moment experience. And as we begin to cultivate wholesome states, the preeminent wholesome states of mindfulness and immersion become possible. So with mindfulness, we really develop the deep investigative quality of the mind, of perception, that we're going to need if we want to really understand things. This is really, I think, the thing that the Buddha had intuited that a lot of people didn't have. The thing that you don't have if you have dust in your eyes is mindfulness. Because mindfulness is the awareness that can look directly or feel directly into an experience and actually understand it. So I can see something that I like and I can say, oh, there's desire. But when there's mindfulness, I don't just get lost in the story or I don't succumb to that desire. I can actually see, oh, this is desire. This is what it feels like. This is what's dangerous about it. This is why it really gets me caught. And this is how I'm suffering in relation to it. Remember that first noble truth, getting what you want. You know, not getting what you want is suffering. You know, getting what you didn't want is suffering. And so mindfulness is the thing that really understands. And when we understand, we're able to actually let go of more and more of that clinging. And then the mind rests into samadhi, into immersion. And it's only really with immersion, the Buddha will say, that there's enough clarity to really unhook from the world. Because it's immersion that teaches you that you don't need sensual pleasures to be happy. Because immersion is blissful. Immersion is these states that some of them are deeply embodied and blissful, some of them are deeply disembodied and spacious and unitive feeling. But they're all, I think what the immersions, what samadhi really is a kind of medicine for modernity. And I'm going to say that modernity in this story begins with agriculture, more or less, begins with the ending of ancient ways of life that were a bit more stable. And that's not a clear line at all. That probably happened over 20,000 years or so of human history. But there's something that the Buddha is experiencing that he wants to understand. And the only way to understand it is to get so still that you can actually feel the microscopic rumblings of discontent as they arise. And so samadhi is both the mental strength it takes to investigate that strongly, but also, and I think this is the medicinal part, it's actually the only time that the mind has ever really rested Because even when we're asleep, we're often spinning in neurotic anxiety, and fears, and hindrances in our dreams and in our restless sleep. And all through the day, the mind doesn't rest for so many of us. And so samadhi at its heart is a resting state. Right? It's a state where the heart mind, especially the neurotic thinking mind, learns how to land in the body and in the present and in the flow of energy in a way that that is finally nourishing, right? More nourishing than sleep, more nourishing than any sensual pleasure, because it's longer lasting and more reliable and goes deeper into the nervous system. I think it's a deep nervous system healing. And the Buddha knows that you can't actually, it's actually very difficult to become liberated purely through mindfulness. There is a tiny path called the dry insight path. Sometimes people can do it, but the Buddha would say it's not easy. The easiest and most pleasurable way is to find your way to immersion. And I think that's a way of saying that that if you want to be able to accomplish your goals, being tremendously healthy is just more helpful than being sick, even though you can do it while sick. And it's not an exact parallel. You can totally get enlightened while sick. But there is something very helpful about the mind, particularly being well, being quite well, being able to turn away from drama and neurotic obsession and just rest. And when we learn to do that, that rest, I think, permeates the being with a different kind of ease and grace and pleasure. And even if you are not skilled at the very deep states known as jhana or any of those, you can still taste it. I think if you've fallen in love with meditation, it's because you've tasted this. It's because you've had moments where things slow down just enough that it feels like, oh, like I can finally feel myself, or I can finally just breathe a little, or I can let the shoulders go a little bit. And immersion is just that amplified and spread out into really the most nourishing states that humans know. And this is the path. The Buddha says, this is actually the way. The thing you guys have been doing, torturing the body, it's not the way. And the thing I grew up doing, sensual pleasures, being a party kid, so not the way. This is the way. And so he says all this. That's the text, the middle way, the Eightfold Path. And he says the noble truths, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, which is craving, the truth of the cessation of suffering through the cessation of craving, and the Eightfold Path. And he says, and then there's this long bit in the middle of the text where he says, I realized it, and then I knew that I had realized it. I made it real. And only now that I've fully made it real am I telling you this. And then this mysterious thing happens, right? He's been talking about craving. He's been talking about the path. He's been talking about balance in the middle way, yes. And then one of his friends, Kondanya, bursts out and says, everything that has begun will end. Everything that has a beginning has an end. Now, this is partly where this text gets really mysterious, because the Buddha did not teach a single overt phrase of teaching about impermanence. The Buddha doesn't say everything's impermanent. Get with that and you'll be free. The Buddha just says, listen, craving, wanting, the states of the heart is where you're suffering, not in physical experience. See if you can get in ourselves right now, see if we can get how hearing that teaching, it's not in physical experience, it's in the states of the heart and the bringing of the heart to peace, how that would lead to the exclamation, everything that has a beginning has an end, right? And there's an implication in there, right? There's an invisible thread that connects the teaching the Buddha actually gave with what Kondanya realizes. And I think it's that Kondanya understands that at the heart of craving is the craving to make something last that by its nature cannot. What is craving but I want this experience to continue? I want the pleasure to continue. I want the pain to stop so that the pleasure can continue. I'm scared that the pain will not stop. So on both the pleasure and pain sides, the implication of this middle way is that everything is impermanent. And so sometimes we go in through the back door and we're like, well, reflect on impermanence and then you'll get to letting go of craving. In this first text, it starts with craving is the thing that's getting you in trouble. And Kondanya says, oh, I see, everything is impermanent. And it's when Kondanya says everything that has a beginning has an end, it's at that moment that the heavens open up. And the text turns from this, you know, teaching to friends of this kind of psychological, emotional, you know, ethical path, suddenly into a mythic, world-shaking moment. And it says that at that very moment when Kondanya utters this, a cry went up all the way to the Brahma world, and from one heaven realm to the next subtler heaven realm, boom, 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 radiating out like a shockwaves heading out through the subtler heaven realms. Out, 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 out. And in each heaven realm, what the gods exclaim as if with one voice is this phrase. At Isipatana in the deer park near Varanasi, the Blessed One has set in motion the wheel of the Dhamma that cannot be stopped by human, Mara, Brahma, or anyone in the cosmos. And what is the setting in motion? The setting in motion, I think, was the transmission. It wasn't actually the teaching. If none of them had gotten it, if all of them had been like the guy on the road, good for you, friend, you know, the wheel wouldn't have been turned. The wheel turned because Kondanya got it. And so Kondanya attains stream entry at that point. And stream entry means that full liberation is guaranteed, right? That the heart has opened, the eye has opened, the mind has opened. And so with Kondanya's realization, then the wheel has been set in motion and it can't be stopped, right? Even if Kondanya was to die in the next moment, within the next few births, he's going to be fully enlightened, he's going to teach, and the wheel goes on rolling, rolling. And so here we are, 2600 some years later. This is year 2567 in the Buddha's year, so 2567 years since the Buddha's death. And the wheel continues to turn. And that's an extraordinary thing, that a teaching was passed from one, as the Zen folks like to say, from warm hand to warm hand. And all the people that came to study, including the Buddha's own stepmother, Mahapajapati, who became the first bhikkhuni and the great nun, and the 500 women that came with her, and all of the friends of Yasa, who was the son of Sujata, who brought the milk rice, and most of the Buddha's family, including his cousin Ananda, who would remember every discourse the Buddha ever gave and repeat them after the Buddha's death to the council of the bhikkhus, and they would be remembered and remembered. And they were probably first written down by the Greeks, who found them within 100 years or so after the Buddha's life. And they were taken around up on the Silk Road into what's now Afghanistan, and Gandhara and Bactria, and all the way up into Europe and over into Africa and over into China, and they spread and they spread. And I found them in the mountains of New Mexico. And you found them wherever you found them. And here we are. And it's 2023, it's 2567, and the Dhamma is still in the world. May the wheel roll on.